From Canada Land, this is The Imposter. I'm Aaliyah Pabani. On this episode...
Are you going to ask me about the ethics of doing something like this?
No.
He kind of stands there, listening to me for a minute. And then he goes, stop stealing my personality.
Poster said something like, do you experience pain during intercourse? And there was an email underneath. I remember it being something really on the nose, like vulva pain study at mail.mcgill.ca. If you're biologically born female, you might have been told that having penetrative sex for the first time would be painful, and that was true for me. But the problem was, it didn't stop. So when I came across this poster, I remember kind of hovering in front of it, mouthing the word yes at all of its questions. They were also offering $100, and I was having the sort of real university experience where you only eat food at faculty wine and cheeses, so I emailed them. There's this test for sexual pain where they poke you with spring-loaded Q-tips on areas of your vulva that have names that sound like appetizers. Names like urethral meatus and... posterior fourchette. So I did this test, and at the end the doctor told me that I had something called vulvar vestibulitis, which he described as an inflammation of the vulvar vestibule that affects about 15% of women. He said that they don't really know what causes it, and they don't really know how to treat it yet, but that I'm lucky that mine isn't so severe. Some people can't even ride a bike, he said. Which... honestly, it made me feel better because my bike was how I got to the clinic. I went to go see the movie Kinsey by myself, which is this movie that features Liam Neeson as Alfred Kinsey, who's this influential scientist in the area of sexology. In it, Kinsey falls in love with his student, who's played by Laura Linney, who has this medical problem that stops her from consummating their marriage. But then after she has this minor surgery, she becomes just as horny as he is. I cried through most of it. The experimental treatment happened in this small clinic at a Montreal hospital. A woman came to get me from the waiting area, and she looked kind of like Mariah Carey as the social worker Miss Weiss in the movie Precious. Like sensible tan slides and a bulky sweater, even though it was summertime. Kind of like she wasn't into the AC at the hospital. She asked me, "Do you have a regular sexual partner?" And I just said yes because I didn't think there would be any follow-up questions. But then she asked me what his name was, so I had to make one up. I don't remember which name I used, so let's say it was Milo. My answers were inserted into a kind of Mad Lib-style hypnosis script that was custom-built for me. And what I mean when I say custom-built is that it literally contained the phrase, "Imagine that you were having intercourse with Milo." The funniest part of the script was actually the part where I was supposed to picture a radio that's pulsing with pain. The script invited me to turn down the volume dial to make the pain go away. She recorded herself reading the script onto a cassette tape, and she told me to listen to it once a day, lying down and breathing. I guess I was supposed to imagine my vagina as a radio while I was having sex, which seems like a bit of an oversight on their part. I would go back to the hospital intermittently over the next 3 months so that she could check on my progress, and I would always make it seem like things were better. Not like Laura Linney and Kinsey better, but So here was this woman coming to this sub-zero hospital room with milky lighting every other week to help an 18-year-old fix a sex problem that has no root cause. I felt like the least I could do was say that it worked. I told her that intercourse was no longer painful and that I had thought about turning down a radio every time. I thanked her profusely. There were no more follow-ups. Until recently, I hadn't really realized what I'd done. I wanted to be cured so badly that I'd fucked with their data. On the other hand, though, people have said that no one can be hypnotized unless they really want to be, so how was I supposed to know when to stop wanting it? Anyway, since then, they've realized that vulvar vestibulitis isn't actually an inflammation, and that one of the causes might be that anticipating the pain causes spasms that actually create the pain. My pain eventually went away on its own, too, which made me think, maybe we were all kind of full of shit.
Wow. So this is where you guys record your show. So cool. And you have a Dyson Airblade in here, too.
That's probably like the most like amazing part of this place. I've never had anyone come in here and react the way that you are.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know what? Maybe it's because other people were expecting more. I wasn't expecting less. I wasn't expecting anything. I had no idea what it was I was doing. So I said, all right, this looks great.
That's nice. Do you think the moon landing was faked?
No, I think that's ridiculous. I think if I thought or my team thought the moon landing was faked, we would have made a very different movie. I think that we were in a very privileged position of thinking that it was ridiculous and the stupidest, I wouldn't say the stupidest conspiracy theory ever, but like,
there's also 9/11. That's a pretty dumb one.
I actually think there's more, not that I'm a 9/11 truther, but I think that there's more of a cultural context for believing that than there is for faking the moon landing. Like,
it sounds like you're a 9/11 truther.
Yeah, right. I bring that up only to highlight the absurdity of the moon landing being faked. You would need to shoot in slow motion video. That just did not exist. To shoot slow motion video in 1968, you would have needed discs like the size of Texas, bigger. Like,
right.
It just could not have happened. It's
right.
it's an absurd proposition. But that's what drew us to the story, because we're like, we don't believe this. Let's try to prove it to people. Let's try to prove the moon landing was faked. And the reason people still talk about it is because the story is so cool.
Yeah.
It's so cool. It's so cool to think. And what's so funny is that the opposite is also true. It's so not cool to do a whole bunch of hard work with a whole bunch of scientists and land on the moon. Like that, there's no story there.
Yeah.
Apollo 13 is a great story. All these people doing all this hard work, and then, oh shit, it all went wrong. Tom Hanks is about to die.
Yeah.
Like, that's a great story. But worked hard, did the math, sent the people, they came back, everybody's healthy, defies our internal sense of story in a way where it's just like, who cares? That's why the second moon mission, people were like, take this off TV. I want to watch I Love Lucy, like, because there's no story to it.
Yeah. And that's kind of been the problem with NASA generally, no? Is that their viewership has kind of dwindled, and so their funding is not what it maybe once was.
Yeah, because sadly, there's no storyline behind hard work and doing it right. Like, there's just people. It's great. It's great for humanity.
Yeah.
But it's not good for Hollywood.
Yeah. I just wanted to hear you talk about what Operation Avalanche is about.
Normally I say it's a fake documentary about the CIA faking the moon landing set in the 1960s, but a lot of it takes place at NASA, and you would think a movie would fake the stuff that's happening at NASA, but because we didn't have any money and because we like shooting in this type of environment, we just went to NASA and shot for real. And all the people who appear in the movie, other than myself and Owen, are also all real. They're just behaving like themselves because they think they're in a real documentary.
So they were like employees of NASA?
The staff that we talked to at NASA, yes, our employees at NASA, who worked there during the Apollo program.
Oh. So you like brought them back in?
No, they still work there.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that crazy? NASA does not have a very high turnover rate, as
yeah,
I'm sure you can imagine.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because there was this one character who seemed definitely like someone who works there, but he also was dressed like someone from the 50s. So I was like, this guy is either like a living throwback or they dressed him up for a documentary.
Not only has the staff not really changed, but their sense of fashion has also not really changed since 1969.
Right. did it require some convincing? Like, are they pretty cagey about letting people shoot documentaries even in there? Or?
Actually, no. That NASA is got a really great program for self publicity because they're government funded. They're not allowed to have a marketing campaign. Like, they can't spend money trying to make themselves look good. So they're actually very open to having artists and people from the media come to them and try to do projects involving them because that's kind of their only way to market themselves.
So did anyone from NASA see the film?
We invited most of the staff from Galveston, the Galveston campus, to our screening at South by Southwest.
Yeah.
Specifically the people who helped us. Two of those departments are now closed. So those people are retired. They don't work at NASA anymore, which is kind of sad. But apart from that, we didn't hear anything back. I hope they really like it. But I'm definitely prepared to hear, oh, that guy's a prick. He used us. We'll never let anybody in NASA again, ever. He ruined our HR department completely. I think as a soundbite, the movie sounds more damaging and critical of NASA than the actual film is.
Right.
I actually think all the people who are in the movie and anybody who was a party to us getting there would actually be very happy with what they're seeing, because at its heart, it still is quite an authentic recreation of what those people's lives were like during the 1960s. And it really is celebrating them. Like, we're not making fun of those individuals at all. It's not like a Borat movie.
Mm-hmm.
What's really cool about sort of the fake documentary space, where people believe that it's almost like you and I talking right now, where it's like, imagine if I was secretly shooting this and my goal was to have a scene with somebody who was interviewing me and was very relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
You're not thinking about being an interviewer. You're just doing, like, you're an incredible actor right now at just being yourself. And it's something that all humans have an incredible talent for, unless you have some crippling social disability. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody can.
But even then, that's just your character.
Exactly.
Everything that is alive is a great actor.
And unbelievably so, in a way that's so compelling when you see it in a fictional film setting.
Yeah.
That you're so drawn to it because you never get to see that stuff. I think in our films, what's interesting is that Owen and I are easily the worst actors of everybody you see, because everybody else is just being themselves, and he and I are you know, trying to create characters, and we're being completely artificial.
Right. Do you think it's more important to just kind of work with non-actors, or?
Oh, I think it's completely different. I think working, as soon as somebody knows they're in a movie, they suck. I'd recently compared this to the Heisenberg principle, where you can't measure the speed and location of a particle, because just by looking at it, you add energy to it and it moves.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same way with behavior and human beings. You're incredible so long as you don't know that you're acting.
Right.
You're incredible. And as soon as I tell you, oh, guess what? You guys are both in my TV show and we're shooting right now and I have hidden cameras everywhere. But just keep going as we've been going and pretend you're not on camera and pretend you're not involved in a movie. It's impossible.
Right.
Are you going to ask me about the ethics of doing something like this?
No.
Oh, really? It's so funny. Normally when I have conversations about this, especially with, you know, like literate people.
Yeah.
One of the big questions is,
like, people who can read.
I mean, culturally literate. Okay. Is about the ethical question about doing things like this.
Yeah.
And my first movie as well, I mean, we shot illegally in high schools with real students who had no idea what was going on, with Owen and I pretending to be high schoolers instead of pretending to work at the CIA. And in that context, we were planning a school shooting, and then we actually go and kill a bunch of people.
Yeah.
You know, I have a funny story about screening that movie at the Sarasota Film Festival, which is, have you ever been to Sarasota before?
I have not.
It's a retirement community.
Okay, great.
Run by, basically funded by the circus way back. It's one of the original circus towns. And there's so many retirees. And
Are they all like retired circus people?
No. Okay. It's just like America's retirement home, one of them. Okay. And I did a screening of The Dirties there. In the movie The Dirties, I'm a student, then I go and I kill a bunch of people. They bullied me. I've got quite hard feelings about it. And at the end, I walk up and this crowd of, you know, octogenarians are shocked. And they're like, what? What's he doing here? Because they assume what they just watched was reality. And that, my God, this film festival has brought the murderer of this movie in to talk with us. Why? Oh, this America. The youth in this country are disgusting. Like, it really was that feeling for about 5 minutes. This crowd was up in arms and couldn't believe that they brought
the Q&A?
That's what was happening.
Oh,
I was brought up for the Q&A.
Did people ask questions? Like,
the first question was, How did you not get in trouble for doing this? But it was a sincere question. Like, why didn't you go to jail for murdering those people in your school?
America.
Well, I actually don't think it's an American issue. I think an extremely advanced community in Canada might have the same reaction. I think it's just those people are not used to seeing like a fake, like they're just taking it as reality.
That's great.
Like they're watching what has all the formal language of a documentary. They think, okay, yeah, this is a documentary.
What an ideal audience. In a way, like this is an audience that like the fourth wall is completely collapsed for. No, I guess I'm less interested in the ethics of it and more in like the questions of like legality and whether you worry about that kind of thing. Like,
well, those are connected. Definitely ethics and law
are
super connected, because typically I think when people think you're crossing an ethical boundary, it's because in the back of their mind they think, well, you also must be crossing a legal one.
Right.
Which is to say that if you're shooting with somebody or you're shooting in a location without permission, that you must be breaking the law or your film will be unreleasable. But it actually is not that way at all, because of the way fair use works, which is in America anyway, it's a legal concept that allows artists the fair use of media or footage so long as they're using it for a purpose that's transformative and critical to the story that they're telling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had to be careful with how we told the story and how things connected to the central story we were telling. An example is in the movie, like we go see Stanley Kubrick and we show the real Stanley Kubrick and we show his real sets and we use all this stuff that we could never get permission to use because the Kubrick estate is very protective mm-hmm. of Stanley Kubrick's image and basically everything from that period. They're extremely protective of it. But we were able to use it for free because it was so critical to the story we were telling. And so we get to do that cool sequence where you really see Stanley Kubrick's set for 2001.
So, but how would you actually go about getting this footage?
That's more trickier. You have to play a lot of games to get that footage.
Okay.
So being a student helps. Ah, man, yeah. That's where you can cross some legal lines because if you sign a contract with somebody and they send you some footage and you're like, okay, I'm going to send this to you, but you can't use it for this, this, and this, and you agree to that, then fair use won't help you because you have a pre-existing contract that says that you can't do that. So you have to find ways of getting footage from people that doesn't involve agreeing to pay them or to not use it. And that's actually not impossible, because a lot of the times people who own huge banks of archival stock footage are willing to send you really shitty versions of
right.
that stuff. Because they know, oh, well, in a theatrical context, you'll never be able to use this. But modern visual effects has advanced to such a place where it almost doesn't matter what they do to the footage, whether they watermark it or make it really, really bad quality. We always found a way of using it, whether it meant like sending it to black and white 16mm film and projecting it on camera or just scrubbing out all the watermarks. I mean, I probably shouldn't be talking about this, but there's a lot of like tricks that we used to get footage that normally you could just never have access to. That Kubrick footage, we just couldn't get. The estate refused to send us anything.
Okay.
But mostly due to the fact that no footage of Stanley Kubrick exists from that period. It just doesn't exist. He didn't allow himself to be filmed.
Okay.
Except under very, very, very specific circumstances. There, our visual effects supervisor, Tristan, just used photographs and animated Kubrick from photos. So he created video from still images. That was a much more labor-intensive process, though.
Yeah, I can imagine. How does that connect to, like, so if you were to alter footage that someone gave you to a great extent, would it then qualify as not really the original footage? Like, at what point does it become, like, original creation, for instance?
You know, like the conversation about this kind of began in the hip-hop sampling world,
mm-hmm.
Where this was a huge, huge, huge issue during the 80s and 90s. Massive. Remember Biz Markie, that album that he got basically killed for, and it's because he didn't clear his samples. And now, that Avalanches album, that first amazing, groundbreaking Avalanches album, apparently has, like, you know, 400 or 500 uncleared samples that you could just never identify.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, it was a completely different world where you had rights holders constantly searching and constantly suing for this type of thing. And things have relaxed to such a huge degree now, where what you could do is, let's say that you were making a movie about Armageddon and Armageddon happening on day one of the Rio Olympics, you could take the NBC's coverage of it And maybe you have it so that that moment is coinciding with, you know, a meteorite hitting and everybody knows about it. You found this perfect moment where it seems like what they're talking about has a kind of double meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It would be within your legal rights to use that for your Armageddon film. And actually, that's not a bad idea. That would be an okay movie, I think, about Armageddon hitting at that specific time. But and the reason it works is because it's contextual. Like, I want to make a movie about Armageddon and the Rio Olympics. That's my movie, right? So then I need to use Olympic coverage because that is how I, as an artist, am setting the context of this film.
Right.
And so lawyers and judges are thinking, well, come on, rights holders, what do you want this artist to do? He's trying to tell the world this new story. Are you going to sit there in judgment of his viability as an artist? What if this is the next film that like moves our culture in a new direction? Like free speech and the importance of art actually is quite important from a legal point of view.
How much did the whole film cost?
About $1 million.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is, I think, more than people would think when they think about like Canadian independent filmmaking. But
right.
for what it is that we did, like that movie should have cost like $15 or $17 million. We spent almost all the money on music and lawyers.
Okay.
Like the actually making the movie cost maybe $100,000.
Okay.
In a narcissistic way, these movies are kind of like blueprints for people to do the same thing. Like when I was a kid, I liked watching media that made me feel like I could do that. Like when I would watch something and be like, oh my God, I want to make a movie. It wasn't when I would watch like a Steven Spielberg movie because those are so formally inaccessible. It's like, yeah, I would like to maybe do that, but I have no idea how. Nobody's going to give me $100 million to do it. It's the very small, agile media where you watch it and you think, wait a minute, there's nothing happening there that I don't think I could do. And reality is, it's incredibly hard to make movies like this. It's not like some 13-year-old kid could watch Operation Avalanche and go out with his friends and do it the next day. But it certainly feels like you could,
mm-hmm.
and that's more important.
Right.
Like the fact that you feel like you could do it because it looks so stupid and easy. That is the feeling that we're trying to capture with young audiences specifically. I mean, not to say, I mean, sure, if some 80-year-old saw it and was like, I could do that, that's fine too. But really, it's about trying to recreate the feeling that I had when I was like 17 years old watching a movie and being like, wait a minute, this isn't so hard. And tricking those people because they will realize then, no, it's incredibly hard.
I guess while watching Operation Avalanche, I found myself doing something kind of similar to what a conspiracy theory nerd would do, which was to like look at every scene and try and kind of dissect which elements were real and which ones were faked. And I felt that particularly for this that crazy car chase scene, it was like a single long take and it just looked insane. You were like driving backwards in the woods, like along a path that I would imagine with a film with not a huge budget would be difficult to fake.
Right.
So I'm wondering, was that scene as insane as it looked? Or
I mean, I drove as fast as I could. I drove as fast as the car would go.
Did you have any like close calls with the other car?
Every single take. One take I hit a tree. One take the cinematographer Andy fell out of the car. One take the camera broke apart because it's the same take where we hit the tree.
Yeah.
And the whole camera hit the window and just completely broke apart. When I was driving backwards, the first time that happened was a complete mistake because the car spun out over the grass because the wheels had no traction. And so I drove backwards because I just had nowhere else to go. And we were like, oh, wait, that looks really cool. We should do that again. And so it was very much like an improvised like workshop on how to do a car chase because
right.
I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never driven a car like that before in my life. And yet, because I'm playing a character in the CIA who also doesn't know what he's doing, has never driven a car fast, is a wannabe spy, where in reality he's a complete neophyte, you're really watching an idiot who doesn't know what he's doing try to navigate a car chase.
Right.
As with all things, when people don't have any money, like we had no money to do that, we really did just have to do it. I mean, obviously me being shot at with a gun is not real. Like
yeah.
The guy basically shoots out the whole front and back window of the car.
Mm-hmm.
That's not real. But all the driving is real. Yeah. That stuff is easy to do so long as you're willing to die. Like, you know what I mean? So long as you're willing to drive that way.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds crazy, but I mean, it is what it looks like. Like, I really am driving through the woods as fast as I can, trying to get away from that guy whose only instruction was to catch me.
Right.
And we shot it 7 or 8 times. And we just shot it all day until we finally got one.
Where was it?
It was actually in Dundas, Ontario.
Okay. Did you have permission, or was there a chance that someone like walked down the street?
Well, there, in that instance, we were very careful to get permission only because we had to close everything down.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, as crazy as I think we are, we would never be trying to take risks like that in a place where like a kid could walk out of a pond and then literally get just vaporized by being hit by a 1965 Ford Fairlane going like 80 kilometers an hour unsupervised.
Yeah. Some things are harder to ethically defend.
That would be tough. That would be like, oh, come on, judge. You don't think I'm allowed to shoot a car chase
we
like that?
We needed the kid to die for the film.
Under
it's
fair
in the script.
Use, under fair use, that kid had to die. Like, that's a more difficult argument, and one that maybe, I mean, I won't even go down this rabbit hole. I was going to say, I wonder if in any context that's justified, but no, of course not.
We'll cut that out.
Well, it won't matter, even if you do. It definitely shows where my mind goes instantly. I'm like, wait a minute, could we somehow vaporize an 8-year-old kid? No.
Depends who it is. Nothing that needs a rebrand more than the word brand. Personal brand, branded content, brand loyalty. The word brand basically kills everything it touches, even though the things that it touches are things we hate to give a shit about anyway. You can call it whatever you want, but FreshBooks did some research and they found that when people customized their invoices with like a logo and matching colors, they had a 10% higher rate of being paid on time. FreshBooks makes it very easy to add a logo, set terms of payment, and even customize your thank you messages. I sat down to make a logo, but since the only thing I could come up with was a line drawing of my own face, I went to www.hipsterlogogenerator.com. Now, my personal brand is this wreath thing with 5 stars on the bottom, like the ones they have on movie posters, and on the inside, there's this cow overlaid with an X made of swords and the word winner on top. I'm feeling pretty positive about my next invoice. FreshBooks makes dead simple cloud accounting software that's transformed how 5 million freelancers and small business owners deal with their day-to-day paperwork. If you want to test out your new hipster logo on a sample invoice, you can sign up for a free 30-day FreshBooks trial and try some of their other unique features too. Just go to freshbooks.com/theimposter and enter the imposter in the how did you hear about us section. That way they'll know that you heard about it here.
A closed meeting of doctors listens as Dr. Fletcher describes Zelig as a human chameleon.
In my second year of university, I took a class in logic where I learned a new sense of the word identity. So identity usually means like who you are. And when you're like, who am I? The answer is usually something like, I'm a Canadian, a writer, a man. All these little like ingredients. But in logic class, an identity was just one thing that's exactly the same as this other thing. So you might say, a lawyer is a person authorized to practice law. That's an identity. When I heard this, my brain sort of exploded. Here was this way of thinking about identity that was so much simpler. And it made me think how, for my whole life, I'd been trying to find my identity, but not in the sense of finding the right ingredients. I'd literally been searching for someone exactly the same as me, my identity.
Like the lizard that is endowed by nature with a marvelous protective device that enables it to change color and blend in with its immediate surrounding, Zelig, too, protects himself by becoming whoever he is around.
In grade 3, I latched onto a boy named Rob McConaughey. Like me, Rob was kind of thin, a little bit nerdy, and wore glasses. I remember going to Rob's house and looking at the trees in his backyard and thinking, I'm glad these are my trees. But one day, I saw his notebook, and it was filled with drawings of stick figures with huge breasts and huge penises. And I was like, actually, this guy is not me. These are not drawings I did. In grade 8, Joey Montgomery came to town. He was tall, witty, and, like me, skilled at ball tech. Unlike me, however, he immediately started dating the highly desirable Mandy Blacklock, who I'd had a crush on since kindergarten. But even though he lived right down the hill from me, both Mandy and I knew I was not Joey Montgomery.
When did the changes begin happening automatically?
When I was copying these people, I don't think I really realized what I was doing, but I was a kid, and kids do weird things. Then I got a little bit older, and it started to go into overdrive. Or maybe it wasn't actually in overdrive, but I became really aware that I was doing it. Maybe it's because when you're a teenager, you're so insecure, and every social interaction presents you with a million ways to say or do the wrong thing, or just be the wrong person. What if someone had just figured it all out? Owen and I met in grade 9. At that point, he was the smartest person I'd ever met. He was a pop culture junkie and, like his dad and older brother before him, already deep into coding. His dad was British and his mom was German, and all of this made Owen seem like he was from another planet. I think Owen's parents were also way richer than mine, but at the time, all I could see was this confidence I didn't really understand. In grade 11, we went to New York together. His sister lived there in a tiny apartment on the Upper East Side, and we stayed with her. As the week went on, my imitating was getting out of control. I was adopting more and more of his mannerisms and vocal inflections, and I couldn't stop myself. I was horrified at how spineless I was being, but I was also worried that he was going to notice. On our last day in New York, I was in Owen's sister's kitchen. Let me back up for a sec. Owen was a pretty sarcastic guy 99% of the time. When he actually liked something, he would say, "It's wonderful." Back to the kitchen. Owen's sister was asking me about my day, like, how's the Empire State Building? And I was like, it was wonderful. She was like, oh, how's the Guggenheim? And I was like, it was wonderful. And she was like, okay, how was dinner? And I was like, it was wonderful. And as I was talking, Owen walks into the room. He kind of stands there, listening to me for a minute. And then he goes, stop stealing my personality. But I didn't stop. In Woody Allen's 1983 movie Zelig, Leonard Zelig imitates everyone around him. In the film, it's a pathological thing to copy people, but it gave me a word to describe what I was already doing. My friend Tim Lillycrap is a neuroscientist and happens to be another guy I used to imitate in high school. Tim does experiments that simulate the behavior of social animals. A few months ago, he was telling me about one experiment that compared imitation to innovation. It turned out, and this surprised a lot of people, that you should almost always copy your neighbor. When Tim told me this, I was immensely relieved. Everyone is copying everyone else, and if they're not, they should be. It reminded me of a time when Tim and I were in university. I was having lunch with our friend Xingming. Tim came over and sat down for a minute and then left. After he was gone, Xingming said, "That was so weird, Steve. Tim talks so different when he's around you. He talks just like you."
People call me crazy, but women are
That was the song Forces by The Submissives off their new album, Do You Really Love Me? Before that, you heard Stephen Thomas reading a piece called Zelig with musical accompaniment by Carl Deiter, and Matt Johnson, who is interested in the fair use guidelines for vaporizing a small child. Other songs on this episode were Form of Space by Elkon and Plastic by Ice Cream, which are both tracks from their brand new albums. This is just a little taste of their life's work, and you can find more at canadalandshow.com/imp. This episode of The Imposter was produced by Katie Jensen. Original music is by Nathan Burley. We're on Twitter at Impster, I-M-P-S-T-R, and I'm on Twitter at Aaliyah Pabani, where I make branded content about my life. If you want to tell us what you thought of the show, or about an artist you think we should know about, or if you have an idea for a freelance piece, email me at Aaliyah@CanadaLandShow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. So if you like what we do, please support us.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.